Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, for welcoming everyone. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to this program. And this program is being done in collaboration with the Lymphoma Foundation of America and Cancer Care. And the topic of today's program is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, or DLBCL, treatment updates. And today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology and Kite Pharma, Inc., a subsidiary of Gilead Sciences, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd like to do a few things. One is I'd like to let you know that there are over 122 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Lebanon, New Zealand, the Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is truly a global call. And it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Catherine Dieffenbach. And Dr. Dieffenbach is Associate Professor of Medicine, Translational Director of Hematology, Director of Clinical Lymphoma, Perlmutter Cancer Center, and NCI, Designated Comprehensive Cancer Center, NYU Langone Health. And Dr. Dieffenbach will be addressing an overview of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, including staging and grading, current standard of care, and treatment options for resistant disease. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Dieffenbach.
Hi, welcome to all of you, and thank you so much for joining this call. So I'll talk a little bit about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. DLBCL, or diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, is the most common aggressive lymphoma. So there are over 68 kinds of lymphoma, and most of them are B-cell lymphomas, and you can divide them into lazy or indolent or aggressive, such as diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And DLBCL is the most common type of aggressive lymphoma. Aggressive lymphomas, unlike indolent lymphomas, are potentially curable, but they do need to be treated. We can't watch and wait with them. So if you're diagnosed with DLBCL, then this is something that requires chemotherapy and usually a monoclonal antibody called rituximab. Now, there are many subtypes of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. A lot of it is quite technical, depending on where the cell that turned into the lymphoma cell, what neighborhood it grew up in, or the cell of origin, and different molecular markers and pathways that these cells might have gone wrong, that might have gone wrong in these cells as they became lymphoma cells. But the basic thing to know is we stage diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in a very straightforward way. Stage one is one site of disease, one lymph node. Stage two is more than one non-contiguous lymph node, but in the same side of the diaphragm. Stage three is having lymph nodes on both sides of the diaphragm. And stage four is having involvement of non-nodal organs, such as bone marrow involvement, liver involvement, spleen involvement. In terms of grade, all of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is considered to be high grade, so there's no really low-grade DLBCL. There can be, we look at the Ki-67, which is the proliferation index, and that can give us some sense of how aggressive this DLBCL is. But whereas, for example, in mantle cell lymphoma, you can have some Ki-67s that are 15%, some that are 30, and some that are 50. Almost all DLBCLs have a Ki-67 that's greater than 90%. There are some particularly aggressive subtypes of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, where there are overexpression or translocations of some proteins called BCL2, BCL6, or MYC. And you can have a double expressor, double hit lymphomas, or triple hit and triple expressor lymphomas. However, in general, The standard of care for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the front line is rituximab, which is an antibody to CD20 in combination with chemotherapy. And for chemotherapy, there are really two options at this point. The standard for a long time has been R-CHOP chemotherapy, which is basically chemotherapy with cyclophosphamide, adriamycin, vincristine, and prednisone, which is R-CHOP. And then there was a trial called the POLARIX trial, which looked at a drug called polatuzumab, which is an antibody drug conjugate to CD9, and substituted the polatuzumab for the vincristine, since they both work in very similar ways. And they found that with the polatuzumab, there were no additional toxicities, but there was an increase in progression-free survival, and that means how long you go without without relapsing for the people on the experimental arm as compared to the standard arm. And so RCHP POLA is now another option that's approved for the frontline treatment of patients with DLBCL. So patients with DLBCL either get RCHOP or RCHP POLA. Patients who get RCHP POLA tend to be higher risk, since those were the patients who were in the POLARIX trial, and or patients who have a non-germinal center type of lymphoma, since those were the ones in the POLARIX trial who appeared to have the highest level of benefit. Our goal with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients is to cure them. And so even patients who have a high prognostic index, or IPI, which is another one of the ways that we stage lymphoma patients, so stage is only one component of the IPI, which is a risk stratification tool for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But even patients with high IPI disease can be cured, and cure is really our goal when we initiate therapy of every diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patient. Now, we can't cure everybody, but we certainly cure many, many, many diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients with frontline chemotherapy. When disease does not respond to frontline chemotherapy or relapses after frontline chemotherapy, really there are a couple of breakpoints. If you relapse within a year of treatment or don't respond to treatment, then generally your next option is a chimeric antigen receptor T-cell or CAR T-cell. These are approved in the second line for patients who have primary refractory disease or who relapse within 2 years. CAR T-cells are where they take your own cells out of your body, they train them to fight lymphoma, and then they give some chemotherapy to make it hospitable for them, and then they put them back in. And sometimes patients need to have some treatment before CAR T-cell because they can't wait in the amount of time between getting your cells out and put back in. And CAR T-cell works best when you have a little bit of disease, but not when you have a lot of disease. Works also well when you have no visible disease. So sometimes you need to have some treatment before CAR T-cell, which could be kind of chemotherapy or a second line chemotherapy or other things. There's just one chemotherapy you can't get before CAR T, and that's bendamustine, because that really affects the quality of your cells. And so you can't have that within 6 months of getting CAR T. So that's not something you want to get if you're planning to get CAR T. For patients who relapse more than 2 years out of treatment or at around 2 years, we still do chemotherapy and autologous stem cell transplant. And then for patients who are not a candidate for CAR T-cell or not a candidate for autologous stem cell transplant, there are many therapies which are approved in the second and third line, the most exciting of which is called bispecific antibodies. These are antibodies that have two arms. One grabs onto a T-cell, which is part of your immune system, and the other grabs onto a tumor cell, and they say, T-cell, eat the tumor cell. And the T-cell basically helps while you have cell death from the chemo, the T-cell also helps the immune system attack the tumor. And these are approved for relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There are two that are approved, glofitamab and epcoritamab. And this is an option for patients who, after CAR T, potentially before, for patients who are not fit for CAR T, for patients who don't have good disease control before CAR T, There are other therapies approved as well, such as Lonco, which is a CD19 antibody drug conjugate, tafasitamab and lenalidomide, lenalidomide and rituximab, gemcitabine and oxaliplatin, glofitamab with gemcitabine and oxaliplatin. So the nice thing about resistant disease and relapse disease is that there are many, many treatment options, even for patients who've relapsed after CAR or who are not candidates for CAR. So that's pretty much an overview. So just to sum up, we basically risk stratify diffuse large B-cell lymphoma based on stage and then other factors such as your overall fitness, whether you have high stage disease, how much your blood counts are affected, whether you're having night sweats and other things like that. Our goal is to cure all patients with R-CHOP-based chemotherapy, and there are many treatment options for resistant disease, including CAR T-cells and bispecific antibodies.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful presentation, Dr. Diefenbach. I'm Stella, and actually, since you're the first speaker, you've really set the stage for today's program, so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Aaron Mulvey, and Dr. Mulvey is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Mulvey will be addressing new and emerging treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment choices, and tips to manage treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mulvey.
Hi, everyone. I'm Aaron Mulvey. I'm an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. I treat patients with lymphoma. I'm happy to be speaking to you all today. I have a lot of different topics that I'm going to be covering, so I'll jump right in. As Dr. Diefenbach has been discussing and introducing, there's been quite a bit of progress that's been made in the way we treat DLBCL. A lot of the treatments that she began to mention would have been considered newer emerging even just a few years ago, and they're now standards of care. Specifically, Dr. Diefenbach mentioned CAR T therapy and bispecific antibody therapy. Both of these approaches have been approved as standards of treatment in DLBCL within the past 5 years or so. And as we're gaining experience in treating more patients with these type of therapies, the way that we use these treatments is continuing to evolve. The first CAR T product approved in DLBCL was AxiCell. That was in 2017. It was originally approved to DLBCL after two or more lines of therapy. Now we have three different CAR T products that are approved for use, and this approval has expanded. We're commonly using CAR T therapy now in the second line, so meaning the first relapse. There's a lot of interest in looking at if there's a role to use CAR T therapy even earlier in the disease. For example, trying to predict patients who may not get into a remission with R-CHOP or Pola-RCHP alone, and using CAR T as part of an initial treatment plan. This is still a research question, though. It's being done in the clinical trial setting, but that's one evolving approach. Similarly, bispecific antibodies were also first approved for use in the third line setting after two or more other treatments. We have two approved products, epcoritamab and glofitamab. A lot of work is being done currently, similarly, to evaluate if these agents can be combined with other drugs to more effectively treat DLBCL. There are studies looking at treatment combinations of bispecific antibodies with other agents in the relapse and refractory setting. There are also studies ongoing that are combining bispecific antibodies with chemotherapy as initial therapy in newly diagnosed DLBCL. So moving these types of treatments earlier in the course of DLBCL is one of the ways that the field looks to be evolving, but these are still being done in trial settings. There's also a number of new promising treatments on the horizon that are being developed. I'll mention a few. First, there's different types of CAR T products or next generation CAR Ts that are being developed. This includes dual targeting CAR Ts. Our current CAR T products target a marker on lymphoma cells called CD19. Dual targeting CAR Ts are designed to target usually CD19, but then also a second target on the lymphoma cell. The idea is to allow the CAR T product to work even if the lymphoma stops making CD19, which can happen, and that's one of the ways that we could potentially overcome resistance. Armored CAR Ts are another modified version where CAR T products get modified to have additional mechanisms that allow them to interact with the other non-lymphomatous cells that are nearby. These non-lymphoma cells surrounding the lymphoma cells are referred to as the lymphoma microenvironment. And these cells can often interact with lymphoma cells in different ways that interfere with therapies from working. So an armored CAR T is designed with different enhancements that allow them to influence the microenvironment and improve the efficacy of CAR T. Novel bispecific antibodies are also being developed. So similar to CAR T, there are many products being developed to target multiple markers on lymphoma cells, for example. These are called tri-specific or they're even quad-specific antibodies. There are also other novel agents that are being used and developed. I'll just mention a few, but this is a long and ever-growing list. One class of drugs are called antibody drug conjugates. These are agents that work like a targeted delivery system. I often like to call them smart chemotherapy. Most chemotherapy just acts on any rapidly dividing cell, but antibody drug conjugates, the chemotherapy gets linked to an antibody that works like a homing device. So the drug is designed to find and bind to specific proteins on the lymphoma cell, and then when the drug finds its target, it releases a chemotherapy molecule. Polatuzumab vedotin, which you just heard about from Dr. Diefenbach, this is one of them. Brentuximab vedotin is another antibody drug conjugate. It targets CD30. This is a drug that we've been using for a while in both Hodgkin lymphoma and T-cell lymphoma, but it's also been recently approved to be used for relapse refractory DLBCL that's CD30 positive. Loncastuximab tesirine is another CD19 antibody drug conjugate. It's approved for use in relapse refractory DLBCL. A few other combinations to mention include tafasitamab and lenalidomide. This is a combination of two treatments. It's an IV antibody with an oral pill that's approved for use in relapse refractory DLBCL. And then another combination of interest that's still very preliminary but showing very promising activity is the combination of two oral drugs, tazemetostat and lenalidomide, along with rituximab. There's an ongoing clinical trial to evaluate this treatment combination in relapse refractory DLBCL, but again, the early data is very, very encouraging and importantly has a very good safety profile. So hopefully the message is coming through that this is very much an evolving, improving, and growing area. We certainly have a lot of room for improvement, but the way that we'll continue to move forward is by conducting clinical research. We're always looking for better ways to treat patients with DLBCL, and in order to make advances, doctors develop clinical studies so that we can thoroughly and safely test new agents and combinations. Every drug that we're discussing today was approved by the FDA after being tested in a clinical trial. There's hundreds of clinical trials being conducted across the world in lymphoma. Trials are available for all different types and stages of lymphoma. Many of these trials focus on studying new treatments. We're looking to learn if the treatment is safe, how effective it is, if it's possibly better than current existing treatments. But trials can also be conducted to study new combinations of already existing and approved drugs or to use existing drugs in new settings. For example, I mentioned before briefly those studies that are looking at bispecific antibodies along with variations of R-CHOP in newly diagnosed DLBCL. Patients who participate in clinical trials can often be some of the first to get a treatment before it's made available to the public. FDA approval typically takes years, even after there's data that suggests benefit from a new agent or approach. So that's one benefit. But of course, there are potential risks with trials, including possible side effects, and also the chance that the new treatment may not work. So it's really important to understand the pros and cons of joining a specific study. I tend to recommend clinical trials to my patients for a number of different reasons. Sometimes a clinical trial may present the best treatment option available. Other times, patients may have specific risk factors or other medical issues where I'm worried that the best standard option may not have the expected results that we're looking for. And so perhaps the added uncertainty of a clinical trial is warranted there by the hope of a better result. Other patients come, they feel compelled to have access to the newest options, or others want to contribute to the progress of treating DLBCL. We also know that patients who are treated on clinical trials often have higher satisfaction with their care and report increased sense of participation in their treatment. Certainly, trials are not for everyone, and plenty of patients, the majority of patients, are treated using standard treatments. But our standards become standards because of clinical research, and our future treatment plans and patterns are developed based on data from clinical trials. So I'm very optimistic that the research we're conducting today will continue to benefit our patients with DLBCL going forward. And then finally, big topic to cover, but I'll end with a couple words about managing symptoms and side effects. In many instances, when a person gets diagnosed with lymphoma and DLBCL, they're often quite symptomatic. And thankfully, with better and better treatment options, I'm always very optimistic that with effective treatment, most patients do feel better. But sometimes symptoms from the disease can remain, even with a good response to treatment. And also, sometimes patients do develop side effects from the treatments that we give. The way that we approach this depends so much on the individual and the context. For example, in a person with newly diagnosed DLBCL who wants to absolutely maximize their likelihood of achieving a cure, which is our goal, right? In most new cases of DLBCL, that's the number one goal. So we want to really do everything we can to ensure that all of the medications get delivered at their full dose and on time. So it's important to be super aggressive in managing symptoms and side effects because we don't want to run into any delays in treatment. Your doctor and treatment team will want to be offering lots of supportive medications to help you cope. For example, if there's nausea or constipation or mouth sores. On the other hand, for a person who's looking to manage their lymphoma, but maybe their priority is really to maintain quality of life above all else, there are different strategies that we may use. Dosage can be adjusted. Maybe certain agents are omitted altogether. So really the bottom line is that you have to have open and clear communication with your doctor so that your team can use all of the tools in our toolboxes to tailor your treatment plan and manage your side effects. There are a lot of side effects that we have very, very good treatments for. For example, anti-nausea medications, constipation, et cetera. Some others are a bit more challenging, like fatigue or brain fog, but that's not to say that there aren't things that we can do. What I think is really, really important, again, is open communication with your medical team, and then having an understanding of the degree to which your symptoms or side effects might be interfering with your functioning and quality of life. A lot of patients often will keep a diary of their symptoms, which can be helpful. I've also had a lot of patients tell me that they use different online patient forums to help gauge if others have experienced similar things. I think that can often be helpful too. Cancer Care, of course, is a great resource. They have support groups online and by phone, and they have really a plethora of other resources for patients too, which you'll hear about more. I'll be happy to take questions at the end of the session along with other speakers.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mulvey. That was just a superb, a stellar presentation, and really addressing with a great deal of optimism, really, the treatment options for patients, and also the importance of clinical trials. And of course, as you've stated, the clinical trials of today really have become, many of them become the future treatments, and that's how we advance the treatment of all of these, of the DLBCL and other cancers as well. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Alexander Boardman, and Dr. Boardman is Assistant Attending Physician, Department of Medicine, Lymphoma and Cellular Therapy Services, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Boardman will be addressing the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments, key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It is my great pleasure to hand this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Boardman.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for the introduction. And again, my name is Dr. Boardman. I work at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and I treat mainly B-cell lymphoma patients, but as you've heard a bit about CAR T-cells this afternoon, I also have a subspecialty in treating patients with CAR T-cells. But today, I'm happy to give some insights into telemedicine, communication with your healthcare team, including about quality of life concerns, and I will dive a little bit deeper into some of the topics that Dr. Mulvey mentioned. I'm happy to sort of give some insights into these issues through the lens of my clinical practice. So I want to start off a little bit about telemedicine and telehealth appointments. I think really, as we've seen since the COVID-19 pandemic began, there's really been a significant surge in telehealth use. And I think, you know, most patients and clinicians really went into the pandemic with little experience or really little training at all on using personal devices to interact with the healthcare system. I think, you know, in the last 5 years, we've seen significant improvements in technologies and policies. And I think that telemedicine, specifically in oncology, really has enhanced our ability to deliver high-quality care. And so just to speak about some of the amazing benefits of this sort of service, first of all, it's really increased access to expert-level care nationally. I do think it has increased access to clinical trials as well, as Dr. Mulvey and Dr. Diefenbach were alluding to, the increased use of clinical trials in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And in my practice, I've also seen that telemedicine has really improved convenience and therefore quality of life for many of my patients. So to put this into context a little bit, at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, we do have multiple sites where we treat patients in the city. However, we have a number of regional network locations in Long Island and Westchester, up in upstate New York, as well as New Jersey. And that's really where the bulk of our patients live, is out in the suburbs. And so this is a really nice service that we can offer our patients by treating them at these regional sites. We actually now treat more patients at the regional sites than we do in the city. And this does include physicians like myself who have clinic primarily in Manhattan but are able to do telemedicine visits with patients from these regional sites. So what this might look like is if a patient is coming in for treatment for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, they'll get their labs drawn at a site that's close to their home. They'll be placed into an exam room and set up with a computer and a device, a microphone and a camera in order to interact with me. I'll perform my typical pre-treatment evaluation, including history and, of course, limited physical examination. But in conjunction with seeing laboratory values, I do feel comfortable treating patients intermittently by telemedicine. I would point out that I certainly don't prefer to treat patients purely from telemedicine. I think it's always important to conduct a physical exam, but I do think that it's reasonable at least every other treatment to see a patient by telemedicine. The caveat to that being, of course, if there's significant disease-related symptoms or significant side effects that warrant an in-person evaluation, then I would certainly change course and have them come and see me in person. But for patients who are doing well, I do feel comfortable with this approach. Moving on to questions about quality of life concerns and interacting with your healthcare team, I think when you're starting treatment for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it's very important to cover with your healthcare provider and their team some of the most common side effects from chemotherapy and what the contingency plans are. So Dr. Mulvey mentioned a number of them. When I do chemotherapy teaching, I tell my patients if there's one thing you take away from this visit, it is the importance of recognizing fevers early and notifying the healthcare team no matter the time of day. So after you've been treated with chemotherapy, typically about a week to 2 weeks after that, your bone marrow would be experiencing the highest impact of that treatment, and you'd experience something called a nadir, which is when your white cells are the lowest and when you're at the highest risk for bacterial infection. And so I tell my patients that any fever of 100.4 Fahrenheit or 38 Celsius or higher body temperature of those numbers, is potentially an emergency and they should reach out. And it doesn't matter if it's 3:30 in the morning, there's a number, there's always a doctor on call, and that person would generally be recommended to go to the closest emergency department or to, you know, our emergency department here at the hospital. For many of our lymphoma regimens, the side effects, some of which Dr. Mulvey already mentioned, but certainly hair loss, constipation, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, insomnia, bruising and bleeding, bone pain, and neuropathy. They're all good symptoms to cover with your healthcare team and to know what constitutes something that you should notify your doctor about immediately versus perhaps waiting until that next visit. And also, as Dr. Mulvey was mentioning, we do have a number of supportive medications that we recommend to our patients, and really leveraging those in a way that's going to help resolve the symptoms in a timely manner is very important. So I always, for example, will mention to my patients who experience constipation, we generally take a strategy of using a laxative and a stool softener combination, and I give my patients some tools as to, you know, strategies as to make sure that they're maintaining regular bowel movements while on our chemo regimens, which tend to have a constipating effect. And so that's just one particular example. The same goes for antiemetics or anti-nausea medicines to really try to get ahead of it. I will say that many of our patients actually do quite well with nausea. We provide a number of supportive treatments to prevent nausea prior to the chemotherapy, but we also, in the event of experiencing nausea at home, provide antiemetics to take in the event that you do have nausea. We've spoken a little bit about clinical trials, and I think some key questions, as Dr. Melvey said, you know, if a clinical trial is recommended for some of the reasons that she mentioned, it's some important questions to keep in mind for your doctor would include, what are the alternatives? If I don't pursue this trial, what would be the standard of care, and why might the trial be more beneficial than that standard of care option? How will my quality of life be impacted? I'm certainly a big believer in clinical trials, but we have to be honest in telling all of you that, you know, generally there could be some extra visits involved. On occasion, there are extra tests that are anticipated. So it's good to just have a sense for what those are. And of course, you know, as I said, alternatives, and important to understand the side effects of alternatives versus anticipated side effects of a clinical trial. So just a few important points to discuss with your healthcare team. And as Dr. Mulvey mentioned, I was also going to emphasize the extreme importance of good communication and transparency. And that's really on both sides. That's on the healthcare side, healthcare team side, as well as on the patient and caregiver side. On my team, we schedule periodic check-ins with our patients who are on treatment. Typically, the nurse in my practice is calling my patients to check in a couple days after treatment to make sure everything's going okay. But then after that, we really do rely on you to let us know if something's not going well at home, right? If we don't hear from you, we assume that you're feeling well. So I definitely encourage you to reach out. And again, as I mentioned before, to cover with your doctor and your healthcare team, what are the symptoms that should be we should be notified about immediately versus maybe in a more delayed sense. I'm going to finish off my portion of the talk by speaking a bit about healthcare technologies, telemedicine appointments, as they pertain to telemedicine appointments, but also open notes. This is something that has had some impact in oncology care of late, so I'm happy to sort of dive into that a little bit. But first, when you're preparing for a telemedicine visit with a provider, I just want to mention a few things that I think are important leading into that visit. So let's say you have a visit scheduled with your oncologist. Maybe it's the first visit. Whether it's the first visit or a follow-up, I highly recommend having a prepared list of questions for your doctor. In the midst of a visit, it can be very easy to forget, you know, a laundry list of questions you might have, whether they pertain to side effects or next steps, diagnostics, etc. So definitely important to jot those down, and I'd recommend doing that leading into the telemedicine visit. If it's an initial visit, it's the first time you're meeting a doctor, and I do on occasion have a first visit with telemedicine for my patients. I do think it's important to have a list of prior diagnostics that you've undergone for your lymphoma, dates of those diagnostics, as well as any treatments that you may have already received. So very important pieces of data for physicians as we try to plan the best treatment course for you, the patient. And it's also important to have a list of doctors who have been involved in your care along the way, because oftentimes it's very important for us to communicate with those physicians. I would also just emphasize it's very important to have an up-to-date list of your medications. I think that's something that often gets lost, and it's definitely important for us to be able to provide you with the highest quality of care. And just briefly about technology requirements, you know, we certainly have seen there be some connection issues. Most computers with web browsing capacity tend to be sufficient for our telemedicine platforms, and most smartphones that are relatively recent tend to be adequate. I'd recommend testing your Wi-Fi connection before the visit and confirming that you have reliable mobile data connection if you're not going to be connected to Wi-Fi. So just a couple things to keep in mind on the technology side. And then lastly, I just want to mention this notion of open notes, which this was actually part of the 21st Century Cures Act, which was passed in the United States in 2016. And this aspect of the act requires that patients are offered all of their healthcare information in their electronic medical record without charge by the provider. And so our patients are seeing not only notes, but also diagnostics in a timely manner. And with this federally mandated requirement in the United States, it's pushing results to our patients on occasion, sometimes before the doctors have even had a chance to interpret the results or even see the results. So it's just something to keep in mind, and this is something I do recommend you discuss with your doctor and your healthcare team beforehand. I would say I do think transparency in healthcare is very important, but in my experience, this has generated significant anxiety in my patients, and so I think it's important to cover with your healthcare team when to expect to hear back about results. I've actually had patients who have resorted to using ChatGPT to interpret their diagnostics. I definitely do not recommend that because really you're missing the context of the whole patient and the whole scenario of the diagnosis. So I think it can be problematic and it can cause misconceptions and at times undue anxiety. So I do recommend covering this with your team, and it's always better rather than using ChatGPT to interpret results to schedule a time to speak with your doctor, whether over the phone or perhaps by a telemedicine visit, to talk about those diagnostics and to talk about those next steps. And so I think I'd recommend covering this early because as diagnostics return, it's going to be tempting to try to interpret those, so just always good to have a plan. So anyway, with that, I'll conclude, and happy to take any questions you may have about any of these issues or others.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Boardman. That was just a superb presentation, stellar in every way, and lots of great information for our participants, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Belita Cowan, and Ms. Cowan is President of Lymphoma Foundation of America, and she'll be addressing Lymphoma Foundation of America's free national programs and services, and she'll be providing you with their patient helpline and website as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Cowan.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for inviting us to partner with Cancer Care. Lymphoma Foundation of America is a national cancer charity that provides services and programs for lymphoma patients. If you are a lymphoma patient or know someone who is, we are here to help you. For example, we give travel aid to lymphoma patients to help with your transportation costs to and from your doctor appointments and cancer treatments. When you contact us, our goal is to help you better understand your situation so you can make informed decisions about your health care. Our phone number is 734-424-2000. And we welcome family members to contact us to learn how you can help as a caregiver and patient advocate. We'll also give you a list of about 50 nonprofit organizations that offer financial assistance with prescription drugs, medical supplies, insurance premiums, legal help, family assistance for pediatric patients, and other patient needs. Lymphoma Foundation of America also gives grants and awards to cancer researchers who are dedicated to finding a cure for lymphoma and who are developing new treatments and studying environmental causes of lymphoma. Please feel free to visit our secure website, www.lymphomahelp.org, for information on second opinions, clinical trials, lymphoma diagnosis and staging, and of course, there are inspirational stories from people who are sharing their journey to recovery. It has been my pleasure to speak with you today, and thank you, Dr. Messner and Cancer Care, for the excellent information we've heard from Dr. Diefenbach, Dr. Mulvey, and Dr. Boardman.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Cowan. That's just a wonderful... and wonderful information for participants and just wonderful resources that the Lymphoma Foundation of America offers. You might want to visit their website or call them, but certainly they offer a lot of practical assistance as well as assistance with making decisions, clinical trials. It sounds like it's a wonderful organization, and we've been partnering with them for many, many years. It's a great organization. Thank you so much, Ms. Cowan. And I will do questions for you during the Q&A as well. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. So Cancer Care is a national organization that provides free programs and services throughout the country. We have what we call our Hope Line, 1-800-813-4673, which is for people in the United States to call. And they often will speak with an oncology social worker and usually have a particular concern, either a practical concern, or they would like to get some counseling services or join an online support group. And we have online support groups for every type of cancer, including DLBCL. And we also have online support groups for caregivers of all ages, relationships. So we have quite a few programs in that respect. And we also, you can also visit our website, which has a great deal of information as well. And we also are working with a trialist, so we do have lots of information about our clinical trials as well. So there's a lot of information out there for you. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions online.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So the question for Dr. Diefenbach, how does CNS involvement impact treatment options? What are the risk factors that contribute to CNS involvement?
Risk factors for CNS involvement requires that you basically address the CNS when you treat. And so we really have to differentiate between patients who are at risk for CNS involvement and actually have CNS involvement. So patients who are at risk for CNS involvement have stage 4 DLBCL with involvement of what we would call sanctuary sites, so testes, testes, also bone and breast and tonsils are all considered to be risk of CNS involvement. This is not the same thing as having CNS involvement. And the data is really inconclusive as to whether in patients who have standard diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with some increased risk of CNS involvement, we actually should or should not prophylax against CNS involvement. There are really two ways to both treat and prophylax against CNS involvement, and they are, you know, you address the CNS generally with a therapy called methotrexate given in high dose, where it's basically given at a dose that will cross the blood-brain barrier or penetrate the blood-brain barrier, and then you rescue the body from not having toxicity by giving an antidote to it called leucovorin. And this you can use to treat DLBCL patients who have CNS involvement or to treat prophylactically patients with, say, testicular DLBCL who have a high risk of CNS involvement. Other treatments would include high-dose cytarabine, which is another chemotherapy that you get at a very high dose. This has both systemic and CNS effects and needs to generally be given in the hospital. And then if there's actual CNS involvement with cranial nerves or other things, you can give chemotherapy intrathecally. So you give it a lumbar puncture or through an Ommaya reservoir, you can give that chemotherapy. And all of these things can be combined or incorporated into the R-CHOP or RCHP regimen. In the relapse setting, if you have CNS involvement at relapse, CAR-T can treat a lymphoma that has also CNS involvement. So this would be a very strong indication to use a CAR-T therapy, which is able to affect both the body and the CNS. However, you are at risk of higher risk of toxicities from the CAR T cell, such as neurotoxicity, with CNS involvement. So this needs to be done under close supervision.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. And another question for Dr. Malze. Is there any linkage between DLBCL and having a family member with lymphoma? For instance, if my mother had lymphoma, does that increase my risk of DLBCL?
Yeah, that's a great question, one that comes up a lot. The short answer is that not directly, but there are very clear increase in the risk of developing any lymphoma if you have a first-degree family member with lymphoma. But overall, that increased risk, it still leads to a low risk. So, right, there are certain types of cancers, like, for example, breast cancer, that have very well-established genetic mutations that are associated with very high rates of developing breast cancer. So, right, if you have a BRCA mutation, your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is somewhere around 60 to 70% or so, for example. With lymphoma, we don't have these identified genetic predisposition syndromes. There aren't any tests that we can say that predict the risk of developing it. And so the associated risk is maybe about two times higher than somebody who doesn't have a family member, but these are still rare diseases, and so the overall risk is still relatively low. There are certain familial clusters, I will say, these are uncommon, where that risk does appear to be higher. You see that a lot more in other types of diseases, like something called CLL or SLL. So it's a complicated answer. There is some increased risk with family members, but it is not thought of as a genetically inherited type of disease.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Boardman, could you discuss, is peripheral neuropathy a permanent side effect after chemotherapy? Are there any, doesn't seem like the person finished their question, so if you could address, is peripheral neuropathy a permanent side effect after chemotherapy?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Great question, and definitely a frequent one in my clinic. Unfortunately, peripheral neuropathy can be permanent. There's only, once chemotherapy damages the long axons that, feed the sensory function of your distal extremities, which include your fingers and your toes, there can be irreversible damage. However, when we do learn about peripheral neuropathy from our patients, as Dr. Mulvey was alluding to regarding holding a chemotherapy drug or reducing a dose, these are some strategies that we do take. In general, a little bit of numbness and tingling, we tend to continue on and push forward to try to maintain the curative regimen. But if it's starting to impair function in any way, such as I usually say opening jars, unbuttoning shirt, using a pen to write, then we start to talk about reductions in the dose of either the vincristine or the polatuzumab, or holding altogether. And so these are some things we can try. I have seen patients who have bad neuropathy who end up having near resolution of the neuropathy, but some patients have had lasting effects, unfortunately. When it comes to surveillance and monitoring neuropathy and possibly treating neuropathy, what I tell patients is lost function is generally not something that we can treat per se, other than by the strategies I just mentioned. However, if there's burning discomfort, which we would call something like neuropathic pain, electrical shock sensation, there are drugs that we can use, neuropathic type drugs, that can alleviate those symptoms. So in many patients, it's not permanent. In some, it can be. But again, we do take strategies to be proactive to try to prevent nerve damage from becoming permanent or severe.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And another question for you, Dr. Boardman. Do you have any tips on tracking symptoms so that I can have a list for my next appointment? I have shown up in the past and completely forgot to discuss certain issues.
Yeah, I think Dr. Mulvey mentioned a symptom diary. I actually recommend that frequently as well. I have patients jot down the time, the severity, the specific side effect or symptom that they're experiencing, as well as anything that was perhaps unusual about the itinerary, the daily itinerary going on that particular time, that can help us to perhaps dive into what caused it and help us to figure out the best ways to address it. So symptom diary is definitely far and away the easiest thing to do to bring to the appointment, and my patients do this all the time. They come in with just pen and paper, and they sort of run through a list of questions, and I try to address all of them. So that would be my best advice.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Mulvey, are there any recommendations for exercising during treatment? I was recommended RCHOP for 6 cycles and am concerned about overdoing it when I work out.
Yeah, that is a great question. So there's lots of supportive treatments that we recommend concurrently with chemotherapy, with the idea that these things are going to allow us to keep treatments on time, get all of the doses in that are recommended, and get people cured. We also are being mindful, though, that once we cure your lymphoma, you're going to go on and live a long life, and we want you to be able to have access to do all of the things that you like to do. And what we see a lot is that people who undergo treatment, even when they feel great and they don't have a lot of side effects, it does change your baseline activity level. It does have an impact. A lot of times people take time off from work, et cetera, and that leads to the loss of stamina, the loss of muscle mass. So the recommendation of doing exercise during treatment as a general approach is a very good one, and that's one I recommend to my patients all the time. At the same time, though, you do not want to overdo it, because you don't want to go in the opposite direction where you're really pushing yourself to do intense exercises and then, you know, you're feeling unwell and wanting to postpone treatment or having other kind of complications. So it is a little bit of a balancing act, but I would say that doing some form of exercise is a good idea. Exercise doesn't have to mean you're going to the gym and doing all kinds of squats and weightlifting, et cetera. Even just spending, 20 or 30 minutes walking is an excellent way to not only engage the muscles, but to also, you know, use the cardiovascular system and try to keep some of that stamina there. So, good idea. Definitely don't need to push yourself. Would not recommend someone to try and train for a marathon or anything like that during treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. And on a question for Dr. Diefenbach, what advice do you have for dealing with loss of appetite? My father is on his second round of treatment and often says he isn't hungry or just that food isn't really appealing to him.
Yeah, it's really hard with appetite because it's so nonspecific, but in general, you sort of eat what tastes good to you and what you feel like eating. Some patients feel like medical marijuana may actually help their appetite, which you can often get from your doctor or from the palliative people who are associated with your doctor, that often helps with appetite. There are a few other things that are more like drugs that are, you know, what we would do if someone was losing weight, but we wouldn't really do that to stimulate appetite. And then the other thing, if your father's feeling up to it at all, is to get moderate exercise, because mild to moderate exercise actually has a very stimulating effect on appetite, so that there are both things he can do to address it. Think about what he feels like eating, and then if nothing else is working, you can also talk to your doctor about medical marijuana, which may help a lot with appetite and well-being.
Excellent, thank you. And for the last question, of the newer treatments, Dr. Mulvey, if you would comment on this, of the newer treatments on the horizon, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, that's a great question. Hopefully we can have time for our other speakers to answer too. I am really intrigued and impressed by this idea of moving some of our novel treatments earlier up, so combinations with bispecific antibodies. And I also think that some of the modifications that are being made to bispecific antibodies and CAR T hold a lot of promise in overcoming resistance mechanisms and allowing these treatments to work, hopefully, for more patients.
Thank you. And Dr. Borman, would you like to add to this as well?
Sure, yeah, happy to. I think I'm a little biased on this one since CAR T cell therapy is one of my areas of expertise, but I'm very excited by up-and-coming CAR T cell therapies that are being produced under a shorter time window. The manufacturing process has actually been limited from 2+ weeks now down to, in some of these products, about 2 days. And what we've seen is that the products actually have a more favorable phenotype, as we say. In other words, they're more fit and they're more able to expand and fight cancer cells. So there have been a number of strategies in the field that are trying to address this issue of CAR T cells not lasting long enough in the body. And I think that between various ways of changing the CAR T cell on the genetic side or even just the manufacturing process, holds a lot of promise in the field and might be the direction that we're headed.
Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Diefenbach?
So I think to echo what both of our other speakers said, so bispecific combinations, you know, which are now in the front line, may be able to cure more people in the front line, so we don't have to take them to CAR or do anything, and you know, do anything with relapse, or we have many less relapse patients. And then, you know, novel CAR therapies. There are also novel bispecifics that have potentially increased immunogenicity. There are also novel drug targets. So not every DLBCL patient expresses CD20, which is the target of Rituxan and most of the bispecific antibodies. And not everyone after CAR expresses CD19. So we need new targets, and there are new antibody drug conjugates and targeted therapies that are being targeted to address other antigens such as CD22 or CD79, which may overcome the resistance mechanisms that rule out classes of therapy for relapsed DLBCL patients.
Excellent. Thank you. And I want to thank all our speakers. I want to thank our participants. I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway. I'll start with Dr. Diefenbach, then Dr. Mulvey, then Dr. Boardman, then Ms. Cowan. So start with Dr. Diefenbach, just a takeaway, like people take away from today's program.
Takeaway, so diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is curable in many patients with frontline therapy, which has been, which standard therapy or through a clinical trial has significant data behind it, and your doctor should be able to get you through it, you know, with only moderate side effects. For the people who are not cured with frontline chemotherapy, there are many options in the relapse setting, including bispecific antibodies, CAR T therapy, stem cell transplant, novel therapies, and clinical trials.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Mulvey.
Sure. I mean, I would echo a lot of what Dr. Diefenbach said, but certainly my takeaway would be one of optimism that there are a lot of exciting and very promising new treatments coming out. We already have a good number of tools in the toolbox to treat this disease, but that toolbox is ever growing with a lot of very effective options, and I'm optimistic that we'll have even more to reach for. And hand in hand with that is the availability of really well thought out, well designed clinical trials that often can hold even more for developing new agents and giving patients access to more options.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Boardman.
Wonderful. Well, I, of course, would echo what both of the other speakers have said, agree fully. Just to pick out a couple points from my part of the talk, I mean, I think that open communication and transparency with your healthcare team are paramount. Really leveraging supportive medications and telemedicine even to improve quality of life. I think that if there's a particular visit that makes sense to do telemedicine, it really does help to relieve the burden of in-person visits and can be really helpful for certainly for my patients and hopefully for many of you if it's appropriate. So I think communication and transparency are the main take-homes for me.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Cowan?
Thank you. I think I speak for everyone in saying that we're all grateful that over the years there have been so many new developments for safe and effective treatments for B-cell lymphomas and other lymphomas. And we're grateful to the organizations that, such as ours, that provide grants and awards to the researchers to help them do this.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I just would like to add that Cancer Care does offer support groups to people, and I think someone asked about a support group. And, you know, there are all types of support groups, both at your hospital setting, in your community, at Cancer Care, at Lymphoma Foundation of America. You can get support groups everywhere. So remember, you're not alone. And you also, your healthcare team, of course, you're not alone. And we are all here to help you. And with that being said, I'd like to just thank all of our participants and thank our speakers as well. And I do want to comment, though, about the fact that we have so many on the call today. We couldn't take all your questions. And so I just want to add that if you had a chance to ask a question today, which many of you did, please, again, take your question back to your treating healthcare team. They know you the best, and you can compare notes with what you learned on the program and what your treating healthcare team has to say. And also for those of you who didn't get to ask a question but have a question in queue, please, again, take that to your healthcare team. Also, lastly, most of our participants are able to reach the healthcare team during the day, but weekends, evenings, and holidays always seem to be challenging. So always get the number for the backup people who are there, backup healthcare team members who are there to take your calls on evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today. This was a very hopeful and promising call. We will be doing many other calls like this, and I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.